Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to tonight's panel discussion. Our discussion this evening is organised by the LSE's Hellenic Observatory. My name is Kevin Featherstone, and I'm director of the Hellenic Observatory here in the European Institute. Our focus tonight, of course, is Greece facing the immigration and refugee crisis. We've all watched on our TV screens, read in the media, of the human tragedies that have occurred in the Mediterranean as desperate men, women, and children have endeavoured to reach Europe. In Italy, the Deputy Prime Minister, Matteo Salvini, turned away, famously, a refugee ship from disembarking in Italy. And only this week, the Italian Senate voted not to allow legal proceedings against him, precisely on that incident of turning away the ship. Being tough on immigrants has clearly boosted the political support for Lega Nord. Tonight, our geographic focus shifts eastwards to the Aegean, the Eastern Mediterranean more generally. Greece, of course, has faced an unprecedented challenge with the influx of refugees, asylum seekers, and migrants. In the year 2015 alone, some 750,000 migrants entered Greece. All this occurred, of course, in the middle of an unprecedented economic crisis in Greece. And there continues to be international concern about the overcrowding in centres on Samos, other islands in the Aegean. For the European Union, for its part, again, it's been challenged by the willingness of member states or the unwillingness of member states to accept principles of equitable burden sharing to enable Europe to better handle the flow of people. Of course, this is an area which is deeply controversial. Leaders like Viktor Orban in Hungary have resisted the flow of migrants and refugees. Indeed, Orban has taken great pride in building a wall to keep people out. Enough said of a politician who wishes to build a wall. And the European Union's deal with Turkey in 2016, of course, has stemmed the flow of migrants, but at what price? And this year, in May, we face European elections to the European Parliament, in which there is expected to be increased support for populist, radical, right-wing parties and the politics of xenophobia. How will the European Union be able to respond to a new politics in the European Parliament to a sensitive area such as migration? We can only speculate. Well, our panel this evening is very well placed to give us better insight into these difficult and very complex issues. So let me introduce them in the sequence that they will be speaking to us. Antigone Liberaki is Professor of Economics at Pantheon University in Athens. She's written extensively on a wide range of topics: migration, aging societies, feminist economics, small and medium-sized enterprises, many international publications. Alongside her academic work, she was a member of the Greek Parliament in 2015 for the Potami Party. She is currently the Acting General Manager for Solidarity Now, an NGO in Athens. Solidarity Now was established in 2013 to assist and support those most affected by the economic and humanitarian crises in Greece. Antigone will speak to us about the role of NGOs in the immigration and refugee crisis. Lefteris Papianakis is Vice Mayor of Athens, responsible for migrants and refugee affairs. He's held this role for the last 3 years. He's a lawyer by training. He's worked in the European Parliament. He's also worked on the education challenges of the Muslim minority in Western Thrace, and he's been a legal counsellor for the Ecologist Political Party. He will speak to us about the response of the Athens authorities to the crisis. Finally, but by no means least, Lilian Zurdi is a lecturer in international human rights and refugee law at the Refugee Studies Centre at the University of Oxford. She's also a visiting professor at Sciences Po in Paris. Her research interests focus on EU asylum policy in the context of its constitutional foundations and administrative governance. She's also published widely on these matters. Lilian will speak to us on the European Union's response to the crisis, how its approach has developed, and the challenges of implementing solidarity measures. Our discussion this evening is being recorded. A podcast and a video will be available to download in a few days' time from the web pages of the LSE's Hellenic Observatory. In addition, our discussion this evening is being live streamed, so there's many ways of access. Both for those watching live stream and those of you here, you can also contribute your comments as we proceed using Twitter. There's a hashtag, suitably LSE Greece, for you to give us your comments as we progress. So we have a complex, difficult, sensitive topic with many dimensions to address. We have an expert panel to help us understand the issues much better. So can you please join me in welcoming our panel this evening? Thank you.
I'm very honored and very grateful for the invitation. This evening I'm going to try and talk about refugees as catalysts for social policy modernization. I'm going to first give you some basic facts, how many refugees and where they are. Secondly, I'm going to give you four very short stories, and then I'm going to talk about solidarity now and social policy. Now, very often one wonders how many refugees are in Greece, because we get the feeling that we're flooded with refugees. According to the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, who do the counting every week, this week we had 71,200 refugees residing in Greece. Of them, 20% are in the islands, some 30% live in independent apartments in urban centres, and another 25% live in camps, sites in the mainland of Greece. There is a remaining 25%, which are unaccounted for in the sense that they don't stay in designated locations. They are staying with friends, or they're squatting, or nobody knows exactly what they're doing. So the idea is that these around 70,000 people have been stabilized in terms of numbers, because people coming in are more or less the same number as those going out. And the financial effort by the European Union to address the problems of these people and of the country that receives them has been very high, of a total of 1.4 billion euros. Not all of it has been absorbed, but all of it has been earmarked for this function. Now, living conditions vary a lot. In the islands, the situation is shameful, nothing less than that. The living conditions are very harsh. Violence is happening most of the time, every day really, people are deprived from very substantial everyday needs. Now, in the camps in the mainland, the situation is much better, but far from ideal. There is still the question of the quality and the adequacy of the services that have been provided to them, the quality of shelter. Sometimes it's just summer tents and nothing more than that. And in Greece, lots of you know that there is lots of rain and snow in the winter. But the main problem with people living in the camps is that they are isolated. They are in the middle of nowhere. They cannot connect with anybody, really, because nobody is around. People in apartments have a better deal. They live in apartments provided with European money, with the intermediation of the UNHCR and the actual monitoring and servicing by NGOs like Solidarity Now. They have access to a number of services, not all of them high quality. But again, the main problem with them is the following. They are deep into a poverty trap in the sense that if they find a job, they lose their cash benefit, which basically means that they do not have any incentive to get out, to learn the language, and to become agents and authors of their own biographies. In reality, they are in a situation of limbo, like stuck in a waiting room with no announcements on the wall. In a sense, a year or 2 years after they entered their apartments, they are less integratable than in the beginning. And this is a failure. So I should say that there are some paradoxes. First, we're talking about a small number of people. And a small number of people in a country of 10.5 million inhabitants, part of a much larger community of countries with 550 million people. The second paradox is that the funds earmarked for their benefits are generous. And if we divide it by the number of people, they should guarantee a much better conditions of living. The third paradox is that some of the refugees living in apartments are having a better deal compared to poor Greeks who have lost almost everything in the crisis. And this is something that is very difficult to talk about, but the people concerned know it. So there is a mismatch between the policy vis-a-vis some refugees, not all of them, clearly, and the social policy addressing the problems of the vulnerable Greeks. And of course, all this is happening in the broader context of a very deep and a very long recession, which has resulted in Greece losing a quarter of what was thought of as its wealth, and with very high unemployment. So the real question is, first, how can we ensure that Greeks and refugees are and are treated as if they were passengers on the same boat, which essentially they are, if there are such differences in their everyday lives? And the second is, how come so many years after the disbursement of funds, the situation remains so harsh, so unlivable for so many people? So I want to give you four very, very short stories to get an idea of the kinds of problems one has to address when dealing with refugee questions. Story number one, a refugee child needs to get a specialized spine operation. A group of very, very highly regarded surgeons was found that they wanted to operate it for free. However, unfortunately, the Greek hospitals could not host the operation because they could not bypass the waiting list and the waiting line. A private hospital was willing to do it, to give its operating theater, but they could not. They did not know how to do it in order of how to register this kind of donation according to their papers. A Swedish hospital volunteered to take the child and have it operated there, but we could not allow this because if the child went there, then she would not be able to come back to Greece. She would most probably be sent in another country, not a safe one. So what I'm trying to say is that even if you manage to generate the support and the kind of help by the people who can solve the problem, refugee work in Greece is like a legal minefield. There are so many difficulties in order to make it happen, regardless of the willingness of people to help. Now, the second story is about unaccompanied minors. We at Solidarity now are not dealing with them, but another organization is. And a donor was asking this woman who is heading this fantastic home project. He said, okay, you have this donation and you are hosting 220 children. Why don't you offer a cheaper kind of package so that you can accommodate all the 2,000 unaccompanied minors who are in the streets right now? And her answer was that the question of quality is not something that you can lower according to the number of the people who need this service. Because if you offer something of a low quality, in the end, you don't offer it. You either ensure life chances and healing for the vulnerable children, for some of them, in order for them to have the chance to live a more or less normal life, or if you give something less to more children, in the end, you don't give anything to nobody. So this is another question that has to be borne in mind, the issue of quality versus quantity. The third story is happier. It's the story of Majd, who came from Syria. He was 20 years old when we met him. We trained him to become an interpreter and a cultural mediator. He had no other formal qualifications with him. He was a very enthusiastic student. He became a very competent interpreter, Arabic to Greek and English, and he managed to get a scholarship to study English language in a private university in Greece with a scholarship with one of the 48 scholarships of the U.S. Embassy. When talking to Majd, he says, oh, everybody's saying we need social integration, social integration. It's not something so difficult that you keep repeating it. It's something doable, provided that there is a willingness to do so on both sides, on our side, that we do the effort, and on your side, that you provide the opportunities. So in a sense, if solidarity offers empowerment, it can really create opportunities and win-win situations. If solidarity exhausts itself as handouts that will cover one pressing need of today without any concern for the future, it can actually deactivate people rather than empowering them. The fourth story, again, is a bit counterintuitive. In recent months, in Thessaloniki, the market for social scientists and social workers is so tight that there is no unemployment at all, and that no non-government organizations are poaching each other's personnel by raising the salary in order to attract good people to perform good refugee work. Now, this comes as a surprise because social scientists in Greece had always a very high unemployment rate. And what I'm trying to say is that refugees and work with refugees has provided a real opportunity for people to do hands-on work and to become better equipped and to also to become highly attractive to employers, which means that this situation with refugees and with lots of vulnerable indigenous groups in Greece could offer an opportunity to latent skills of people to be to become active and to offer support. Now, Solidarity Now, I'm going to give you a very, very brief outline of what we do. We have so far, although we were set up in year 2013, as Kevin mentioned earlier, in order to address the impact of the financial crisis, we created two solidarity centers, one in Athens, one in Thessaloniki, with the idea of offering free services, legal, psychosocial, and employability services to vulnerable Greeks who lost everything and who we wanted to attract and not actually let them become attracted by Golden Dawn and by other extreme outfits. So when the refugee wave arrived in 2015, we were already there, and we basically tried to implement the same model of work: solidarity centers, free for all sorts of different holistic services to anybody who needed them. Besides this, we also run an accommodation program, education programs in camps and in the urban centers. And so far, we have interacted with 300,000 individuals. From our solidarity centers, we have two in Thessaloniki, one in Athens, have served more than 120,000 people. We have offered education in camps to 14,000 children so far. We have accommodated over 7,000 people so far, but at any one time we have a capacity for 2,200, which is quite substantial. By accommodation, I mean independent apartments. We don't work with in the islands. We have been involved in non-formal education, and we have had a very inspiring and good experience with more than 6,000 children and young adults. And we employ currently 364 people, and our budget last year was 12.5 million euros. This year it's going to be, 2019, it's going to be close to 16 million. So what I'm really trying to say is that Solidarity Now was and is an organization that is concerned with social policy. We have learned lots of lessons while working with refugees and with vulnerable Greeks. And one of them is that we need to align the benefits and the services provided to refugees and Greeks alike, having very different quality and type of services can create difficulties rather than solve problems. We have realized that social policy is not something that concerns only the state. Civil society, international donors, volunteers can and should all be part of this by adding value in a concerted manner. Social policy can provide, NGOs doing social policy can, and by thinking out of the box, can try and test new ideas about how to address a problem rather than going full scale for the whole of the population. And in that sense, it can be very useful because you can see what works, what doesn't, and how you can amend it and then scale it up. And lastly, we have seen that we are faster to understand how we can introduce initiatives that can address different needs of different groups of people. To give you just one example, by offering what we are going to do, a certified training course for long-time carers for the elderly. Greece is the fastest aging society in Europe, so not only we have lots of elderly people, but in the future we're going to have much more than them, of them. So by creating a training course for certified carers and attracting both Greeks and refugees to take part to it, we can bring together the needs of Greek elderly, unemployed young Greeks, and refugees who want to make a living and have opportunities in their lives, and sort of creating an intergenerational and inter-ethnic bridge, which is something which is completely new by social policy standards in Greece. So what I'm really trying to say, and I'm closing with that because I've already exceeded my time, is that there is a way of getting involved into refugee work that helps us understand better social problems that have not been addressed and were there even before the arrival of the crisis and the refugees, that by getting experience from working with refugees, we understand what is needed more widely in the society. And in that sense, we think that we contribute to the modernization of social policy, which so far has left a lot to be desired. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Antigone. Lefteri, can I invite you to address this?
First of all, thank you for the invitation. Allow me to pick up a bit where Antigone left her speech. If I seem a bit scattered and a bit vague, please find me with the questions and try to make it more concrete, because one of the main issues that the municipalities and local authorities have in Greece is that the context that is being described, and you will allow me not to call it a crisis, because I don't believe that we have a crisis. Migration crisis, no. We have a financial crisis, which is an actual crisis. We have an institutional crisis, an ideological crisis, many types of crises, but not a refugee and immigration crisis. But for the sake of the discussion, I will keep calling it a crisis just to to keep with the format. So we had to face a crisis within a crisis within a crisis within a crisis. And local authorities do not have the competency to deal with migrants and refugees from the point of view of integration and reception. So that means that we don't have any budget, we don't have any personnel that has the specialization to deal with refugees and migrants, because not everyone can deal with migrants and refugees. You have to have some type of expertise. And we didn't have the capacity. I mean, specialized services, accommodation, et cetera, et cetera. So what that meant that was that the mayor, because we have a very mayoral system in Greece, had to take the initiative and decide to be implicated or not, or to participate in the management of this crisis. The mayor of Athens did so, and he was the first to react. And he had to react because the reality in the field was that we had occupied squares, occupied parks, people in the street, so we had to find some type of solution. Moreover, in the beginning, Athens and Greece was a transit country. People just passed through, and in 2 or 3 days they left. That was the flow and the Western Balkan route, et cetera, for those who followed up a bit the discussion back then. When the borders closed back in March 2016, immediately Greece was transformed into a reception country, a destination country. That meant that we had to adjust the policy, and we had to invent, if you want, or to create things that didn't exist in a very short amount of time, and then local authorities had to pick up the slack where the state was failing, because a lot of European states failed in that context, Greece also. So we had to, first of all, we created an accommodation center near the center of Athens, Eleonas, for those who have been to Greece or have visited or read about it. We are hosting actually 1,700 people. Most of them are now there for over 2 years. And this temporary housing facility is turning into a village, and we have to see how this will evolve in the next months or so. The second big thing that we did is that we participated in the accommodation scheme of UNHCR, hosting refugees into apartments. We actually have in Athens, and when I say Athens, I mean only the municipality of Athens, because many people mix the municipality of Athens with Athens, the region of Attica. The region of Attica has 4 million inhabitants. The municipality of Athens has 665,000 inhabitants. Athens, as a municipality, actually hosts 25% of the numbers that you heard from Antigone. We are hosting, give or take, 18,000 people. So 1,500, 700 in Eleonas, around 10,000 people in apartments, 2,000 or 3,000 in squats, and we have people coming in and out of the city every day, every week, and we have also people who are living on their own, and we really don't know where they are. So we estimate that this number is around 18, maybe more, but let's say 18,000 people. So Athens is hosting 25% of the total population of refugees in Greece, which is a lot, because Athens represents 7.5% of the population of Greece. So the responsibility and the solidarity that Athens is demonstrating is huge. And because we are talking about solidarity and we are looking for solidarity from our European counterparts, I have to say that there is no internal solidarity in Greece. Most of the municipalities do not participate. They're actually hostile. So we are leading a network of 13 cities in Greece. Of course, in these 13 cities, we have the big three, as we say, Athens, Thessaloniki, and Piraeus, which is the port of Greece, the big port of Greece, which is a very positive thing. But the rest, the 310 municipalities that are apart of the 13, are not participating and are actually hostile in hosting refugees. So when we ask about international solidarity, we should first ask for internal solidarity and then have the argument to ask for European solidarity. So this is a big question for us. What we did then after the housing scheme, which has been proven very, very successful, although now we have to move on to step three, meaning hosting recognized refugees into the urban environment. That means that recognized refugees have the same rights as Greek citizens, so we have to find solutions for housing, which is very, very complicated. Housing is going to be probably the most important challenge for Greece for the hosting refugees. In Athens, we are facing a huge issue, and I will not develop it more, but if we want, we can discuss it about later. We are missing apartments due to Airbnb. And this is a very big question for us, because we don't have any possibility to regulate this new reality for the city. And we have whole neighborhoods who are out of the market, because all the owners are giving away their apartments into Airbnb. So we have to see how we are going to tackle this challenge. And I'm not saying that Airbnb is the devil, far from that, but we need to regulate, and we have to find some common ground to keep social cohesion, because social cohesion is affected by these types of sharing economy examples. What we did then, after the housing scheme, was we wanted to participate in the coordination of the hundreds of NGOs that are present in Athens doing work with refugees. We created a coordination center for migrants and refugees, and we have now more than 99 members. So Solidarity Now is part of it, an active one also. We have, from the Ministry of Migration to the last Greek small NGO that is dealing with refugees and vulnerable Greeks. So we're not trying to coordinate in the sense that we are telling them what to do, but we want to know what is happening, and we are trying to find solutions into problems that they have, but also the municipality has. Because I have to remind you that local authorities are not an NGO, and we are operating within a legal framework. NGOs have a bigger, leeway in their operations. We do not. It's very, very complicated for us to be as flexible as the NGOs. That's why we collaborate with them. We have signed many, many MOUs with UNHCR, IOM. We are signing one now with Solidarity in the next few days, in order to find solutions to problems that the municipality has, because offering services to the newly arrived people is difficult for the municipality for the reasons I mentioned before. So we use the NGOs in order to find solutions to service provision, because this is the main task for a local authority, service provision to all, without any discrimination. And in Athens, we do not discriminate anyone. Even people without documents have the right to access basic services. This is something very, very important for us, and it's another big challenge that Europe is going to face: undocumented migrants, people who are going to be out of the asylum system and who are also going to be unreturnable, because many people think that whoever is out of the asylum process is going to be returned. There is no bigger lie than this. No bigger lie. And this is going to be faced by cities. What is happening is not in the country. Things are happening in the cities. And this is the third big challenge that we need to face: the difference between the national approach and the European one, of course, and the local approach. You have now many, many municipalities that are fighting the government for the policy implementation and the choices made on the European level. I can give you the example of Barcelona and Madrid, who are fighting the Spanish government. Paris is fighting the French government. Amsterdam, Utrecht, Rotterdam and The Hague are fighting the Dutch government, who has done enough, but still. And of course, all the municipalities, and of course, all the Italian municipalities who are fighting the Italian government. You have to see what the mayor of Palermo is going through. We had a mayor in Italy who has been arrested for hosting refugees, for illegal trafficking of migrants, and he has been sent to jail. I think he's out, but he was arrested because he was hosting refugees. And now we have the mayor of Bayonne in France, near the Italian border, still receiving refugees, although the government is very, very hostile. So this fighting is going to go on for a long time, and we will have to find some type of solution. Now we are also implementing an integration project, which is a pilot project, as we call it, with European money, and it's called Curing the Limbo, one word that Antigone used, meaning we are trying to mobilize people who have been in Greece for more than 2 years doing nothing, and now we have to step up and offer them possibilities and solutions for the next day, because apparently 50% of the people that we have now in Greece are going to stay in Greece. And I'm saying 50% because it's going to be the rate of approval of asylum of the 72,000 people. So we can imagine that around 40,000 people are going to stay in Greece. I'm not going to discuss what is going to happen with the rest. We can talk about it later. We also have a big help from our partner cities in Europe. We participate in large European networks, and we are exchanging good practices, and we are getting a lot of good examples to implement in Athens. And I have to, and I'm very grateful to our colleagues in Europe. And through this process, we find also solutions in questions that have never been answered. So the question of undocumented migrants is a big one for us, at least for the cities, and we are looking into it. I would like to end just with a small story. 3 months ago, we had a visit from a delegation from South Korea. We had 20 people coming from South Korea, from the municipality level, the regional level, and the national level. We were discussing for about an hour. I didn't get why they were there. I was polite, and I was trying to understand why they came to Athens. They were looking into our accommodation scheme, and they were looking into how we hosted refugees in apartments. The team was there, the project manager, and we were discussing, and I was trying to understand why they were so interested. In the end of the hour, the leading figure said that we are here because one morning we woke up and we saw 150 people from Yemen in the borders of South Korea. And the problem of South Korea was 150 people from Yemen. First of all, they didn't understand how they got there. And secondly, they didn't know what to do with them. I laughed. It wasn't very polite, I have to say. And I told them, welcome to the future, because this is going to be the future of the world now, if you want. And we can discuss how they got there. We found out that they took a plane, and they went to Indonesia, and then they moved from there, etc. So people move, and they know how to move, and they will find ways to move. And I'm saying this story because this is the future, and we are looking it on the wrong way. We have to change completely the perspective. Human mobility is human history. We are here because we moved since the beginning of time. I can say that this is a human right, and yes, I know it's a bit excessive, but if someone can find a way to stop people from moving, please share it with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed. Lillian, can we invite you to speak?
Thank you very much for the kind invitation. And I will be focusing on the EU level and the development of the EU asylum policy and the responses of Europe to the migration and refugee crisis. But in my work, I also contest these terms. So I contest that we actually are dealing with a refugee crisis, as in a crisis that is due to the numbers of those arriving. And rather, I believe that we are dealing with a governance crisis. So the crisis is at the level of the legislative design and the implementation modes of the EU asylum policy, rather than due to the numbers of those arriving. So what are these implementation modes? So how was this all supposed to work? Because the output at EU level was supposed to be a common European asylum system. And when we hear these terms, one can imagine perhaps EU-level processing, so that some kind of EU agency would be responsible for the applications, or one might think of EU funding, that the activities around asylum, since it is supposed to be a common system, are somehow compensated through the EU budget. This is not exactly how it was designed to work. So actually, we are talking about 28 different national asylum systems that were coordinated through harmonized legislation. So one of the problems was that although the goal was a common area within the EU of solidarity, where we would have high procedural standards and common reception conditions, this was supposed to happen merely through legislative harmonization. So just because we wrote it, it would be so. And not enough respect was had to the different levels of economic development, the different development also of the national asylum systems, the different conceptualizations of welfare in the 28 member states. So the second problem is the system of responsibility allocation. You may have heard of the notorious Dublin system. So since we have an area of common circulation of persons, and since we were supposed to have a common European asylum system, there were two things that policymakers wanted to avoid. First of all, that no country would accept a specific refugee, so that we would have the situation of refugees in orbit, so someone arriving in the EU and France saying, no, it's not me that is responsible, it's Germany, and so on and so forth. And the second issue that they wanted to avoid was the so-called asylum shopping, so that actually asylum seekers would move from country to country within the EU, constantly asking for asylum. So there had to be some coordination, some way, in order to pin down among the 28, so among these 28 national systems, who would be the member state that would be responsible. And they came up with a list of hierarchic criteria that are basically linked with the responsibility of presence. So which member state actually, in a way, it's not written like that in the regulation, but this would be the result. So which is the member state that is responsible for the asylum seeker being in the EU territory? So the first criteria are linked, for example, with a member state having issued a visa or a residence permit. But for those of us who are aware about how the EU visa policy works, it is actually very difficult for an individual that comes from a refugee-producing country to procure a visa. And so you will not be surprised to hear that most of the arrivals in the EU territory are through an irregular manner. And here we have the very important criterion of the first country of entry. So the country that will be responsible for the processing of the claim and also providing reception conditions, and later on for integrating refugees if after the processing they are found actually to fulfill the criteria, would be the member state of first entry. Of course, thinking of geography, we understand that a system thus designed to allocate responsibility creates asymmetrical burdens for member states at the external borders, and such is also the case of Greece. At the same time, there was very little that was embedded in the initial design to counterbalance this. Although we have a principle of solidarity and fair sharing of responsibility enshrined in the treaties, for years this remained a dead letter. So what we have that has been somehow strengthened through this process that has been termed of the crisis, to actually try to operationalize solidarity, to move away from this implementation designs, are three things. The first is an EU agency, the European Asylum Support Office, that is responsible for providing operational support and practical cooperation. So how did it look like? At the beginning, it actually looked like the work of deployed experts through this agency in member states looked a bit like expert consulting. So they would go to a ministry, they would do some training of judges, or they would discuss on how to fix a system of allocation of reception places, but they could do nothing actually to address structural needs. So they couldn't do nothing as to Greece having, for example, in 2011, only 1,000 reception places. So gradually, and especially since 2015-2016, these operations, these deployments, have become more hands-on. They have become numerically more robust, and we have patterns of joint processing emerging. So we have these deployed experts at Greek level working alongside the Greek administration, processing claims. So they are conducting a part of the asylum processing. They are handing an advisory opinion, and the Greek asylum service is responsible for the final determination. So we are beginning to see the EU level integrating with the national level in assessing these claims. And this could be understood, of course, indirectly also as a measure of solidarity, since there are more resources. The second measure was emergency relocation. So I explained to you how responsibility allocation was supposed to work. So those who arrived in Greece should have been processed by Greece. Those who arrived in Italy should have been processed by Italy. And it was felt during 2015-2016 and the increased arrivals that the result, for the first time it was publicly acknowledged, that the result in terms of responsibility sharing would be patently unreasonable. So what happened was an exercise in intra-EU transfer of asylum seekers from Greece and Italy in other member states. These were the so-called emergency relocation schemes. The third solidarity type measure is EU funding, and mainly emergency funding. So as I mentioned to you, this is not geared at fully compensating member states for their efforts in implementing. This funding should come from national budgets. And what is happening at the EU level is a kind of EU top-up that had a specific budget line called emergency budget line, which during 2015 and 2016 grew enormously. And we had Greece and Italy, but also further member states drawing from this emergency funding. So this points to the fact that there are structural needs for EU support rather than emergency needs. So what is the main problem with all these approaches? It is that they are largely emergency driven. So there is always the assumption that the system as initially designed is fine, and that there is an exceptional emergency where we can have a quick fix, a small tweak, and afterwards everything will be fine. But this is not the case, since the system, as it has been designed from its inception, leads to an inequitable distribution of responsibilities. And at the same time, there has never been any effort actually to objectify responsibilities. So if we think of the arrival of, let's say, a random number, 20,000 asylum seekers in Germany and in Malta, commonsensically, you will understand that the arrival of 20,000 people will have a different impact in a small island state and in one of the larger and more economically robust member states. So when we try to apportion responsibility, already some objective indicators such as, I don't know, unemployment rate, population size, gross domestic product, must have something to do with it. No such effort actually has been done at the EU level, and responsibility is actually attributed in the manner that I described to you, so via the responsibility of presence. So what way forward? There seem to be two ways. The one would be greater integration between the EU and national levels in administering the EU asylum policy. So I mentioned to you some emerging patterns of joint processing, for example, in Greece. So further, if you wish, deployments or more collaboration between the EU and national levels. And the second is a more robust funding component. So rather than talk about emergency funding or the other budget line from which the programs that the colleagues mentioned draw from, which is intra-EU humanitarian aid, which actually was instated in 2016. Until 2016, humanitarian aid was only directed towards third countries, but in 2016, for the first time, we had a new budget line of intra-EU humanitarian aid that was immediately activated for the benefit of Greece in the framework of the so-called migration crisis. But this is also an exceptional emergency-driven response. It can last for a maximum of 3 years. It is going to expire in 2019, and we will see what happens next. So rather than that, to pass more to a compensatory logic. So member states to be compensated, if you wish, through the EU budget for their efforts in asylum protection. Of course, this has many, the realization of such a goal has many problems. The portfolio for now of home affairs from which EU migration funding is drawing is quite limited, and the general EU budget is also in comparative terms, if you will, also quite modest. So this would take a radical rethinking of the EU budget, but it could be another way forward. For now, what we have mainly chosen to do is externalization. So Professor Featherstone already mentioned the EU-Turkey statement, the so-called EU-Turkey deal. So rather than dealing with the issue of intra-EU solidarity, what the EU is seeking to do is to externalize its protection obligations to third countries, which merely delays but does not address the structural deficiencies of the EU asylum policy. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Lillian, very much indeed, and thank you to the panel. We have some time now for questions and contributions from you, from the audience. There are colleagues in red T-shirts with microphones. So if you could indicate, if you wish to ask a question, could I ask you to identify yourself and then go to the question? Could we take the lady at the back here, please, first? We'll take a group of about three.
Okay. Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. My name is Josephine Herrible. I'm from the Workers' Institute, and I just thank you for the discussion. It's very interesting, but the panel is very diplomatically not making any mention of Britain's immigration record. What does the panel say to the charge that Britain is operating an unspoken colour ban, in other words, apartheid, against immigrants? And I, for myself, I just like to say there's nothing more that I feel more ashamed of than having been born British.
Okay. A very topical comment, I think. Could we take the gentleman at the back in the middle, please?
Hi, my name's Nick. I'm from the studying migration here at LSE, and I spent 2.5 years working on Chios Island. And I guess my question really is, we're now nearly the third year of the EU-Turkey deal, and basically it's quite cyclical. Every year things get worse in the wintertime on the islands. Samos is in a complete state. And I wonder, what is it that's preventing even the conditions on the islands being improved? Is it I don't think it's a lack of funding, because you said how much money has been coming. So is it a lack of capability? Is it a lack of willingness? Is it really what? Is it EU using the islands as a deterrent? I wonder, in your opinion, I think one comes from an NGO's opinion, academic, and then we have the sort of political opinion. It would be interesting to hear if they all agree or differ.
Okay, thanks very much. And yes, can we take the lady in the middle? And if you can, we take four questions. Is that okay, panel?
Yeah, yeah.
Hello, I'm a graduate student from Padion University of Athens, and I'm an intern here at the Greek Embassy. When I was in Athens, I was a volunteer at the Greek Council for Refugees. I found this organization by my own, and I had a lot of conversation with my friends in my university. They wanted to offer their help, their knowledge, and help other people experience different cultures, learn. And they find it difficult because the universities do not cooperate with organizations. And my question is, what we can do in order the universities to cooperate with organizations and to let younger people to help, to offer their help?
Many thanks. And then there's a question. Yes, could we take the lady here, please?
Hi. First of all, thank you all for coming. I'm Zoe. I'm just an LSE econ student here. And I'm basically, I lived in Kilkis my whole life, which is like basically in the borders, for those who don't know. So my main question is, how do we deal with xenophobia in Greece? Because there was a huge talk about how we don't discriminate, but this is like turning a blind eye on how much we actually are xenophobic in Greece. And how, so my question is basically, how do we deal with the issue of xenophobia that can arise from just purely lack of education, question mark, or just because people have been like that throughout our culture?
Okay, many thanks. Can I invite the panel to pick up on any particular point they wish? Antigone, would you like to go first? It's on, I think.
It's on, right. Okay, thanks for the question. You realize that there is no way of mincing my words, so I'm going to be straight, and I'm saying that the question was... why 3 years after EU-Turkey statement and after so many generous funding, the situation in the islands remains appalling. And it, in some ways, it can be said that it's even worse than 2 years ago right now, especially in Samos. Okay, so one question, answer would be incompetence. The camps, the reception centers in the islands are operated by the army due to their sensitive border nature. The army, I don't know if they know how to do war, but definitely they don't know how to deal with refugee camps. And this shows in all aspects of their running this business. By the way, they put together groups that are basically incompatible between them because they will kill each other. By the way that they cannot stop violence, half of the traumatized children that arrive in Athens have been traumatized while being on the islands, not in Turkey or Syria or Afghanistan or the moon. So one thing is that they don't know how to do it, and they don't want to learn also, and nobody presses them to. The second issue that I have to mention, although I cannot prove it, is the shadow of corruption, especially the issue of food distribution is fraught with questions regarding corruption. It seems to me very difficult to understand why food chains located in the northern suburbs of Athens are supplying 3 meals per day in the camps on the islands. The food is half-cooked. People need to put fires in order to complete the cooking. They set fire in the camp as a result. Not to mention that you get all sorts of foods that are not these people are not allowed to eat, like pork, for instance. So Solidarity has made made a petition to the Petition Committee of the European Union two years ago, in March 2017, asking for an investigation. As a result of which, and I guess other petitions, I don't know, Olaf has been activated. We're still waiting for the result. But as long as the procedure follows the emergency process, there is ample room for mismanagement or open corruption. On the other hand, you cannot deal with pressing situations if you go by the book of the normal disbursement of EU funds, because it will take 14 months before the first meal is distributed. So, I mean, you don't have any recipients in that case. Now, the third and most difficult answer is political unwillingness to improve the situation. There is a subtext in all our discussions with the Greek government, even with the nicest people of them, who imply that the moment you transfer people from the islands to the mainland, an equal number of people will arrive. This is a conspiracy theory suggesting that human traffickers are scrutinizing the mobility of people within Greece, and the moment they see that an open space, as if they transfer people because there is a place for them. So a combination of all these three reasons, I think, would give partly an answer to your question. I wish I had a more convincing answer.
Thank you very much. Vitaly, do you want to address the question about how Greece deals with xenophobia?
Yeah, just also on the first question.
Briefly.
The EU is implementing a deterrent policy. The rest follows, just to be very clear. All of us do, because we all signed on it. So this is the first thing, and then all the rest is following. On xenophobia, the way to answer to xenophobia is to be vocal. And why I mentioned the non-discrimination policy of Athens is one of the elements that we use in order to counter xenophobia. The role of the local authorities and institutions is to be fair, equal, you know, equal treatment, open, and very vocal. We do not have to be afraid of the political cost, because the political cost in the end will eat you up in this context, because people are afraid that if you treat refugees as you treat Greeks, people will say, why are you doing so many things for refugees and nothing for us? When they ask me that, I say that this is my job, and you have other people who are doing the job for the others. So if you combine all of it, you find if we do enough or not. So we, as a local authority, we have to be very, very vocal and very, very clear. I'm on the observatory of the trial of Golden Dawn. As you know, in Greece, we have a party called Golden Dawn. It's an actual Nazi party, and they are on trial for being a criminal organization. In Athens, they got, in the last election, 16%. We have neighborhoods in Athens where they got 20%. And they were second behind the party of the mayor. So it's an actual danger. What we try to do is to show to the people that this is not the solution. This is only the easy way out. And you know, we are trying to convince other people to follow also this example. For the university. My actual work is, I work at the University of Athens as a public servant, and the University of Athens very quickly created an observatory for the refugee situation. I think that the other universities in Athens also should do something similar and try to coordinate with local authorities, organizations, etc., etc. As we collaborate in the municipality with the Greek Council of Refugees, we have a very close relationship. I can imagine doing the same thing with the other universities, but it's up to them to decide. And this is something of a political will question. And I think that the students, that because you are hundreds of thousands of you, you can push the university to be more open. I know the difficulty for the university to be open. I work for it, so I know how difficult it is to mobilize them. But it's up to you also. I mean, okay. You have to present a demand.
Can we move on to Lillian? Would you want to pick up perhaps the role of universities?
Yes, but first I would also make a small comment on the hotspots as centers in the islands. So their original name was actually Centers for First Reception and Identification. So stay of those arriving in those centers was supposed to be short term. They were never meant to be used as long-term accommodation facilities. What happened is that after the EU-Turkey deal kicked in, those arriving at the islands were supposed to be immediately returned. Of course, this is not the way that the EU asylum system works. There are procedural guarantees, and so returns were not as swift as decision makers had wished when they instated this arrangement. And thus we started having congestion in these centers that were conceptualized as short-term initial reception and registration centers, after which those who arrived would have been transferred in other units in the mainland. And so the situation with this also overpopulation keeps getting worse. There is also at the political level, it has been said that Turkey has stated that whoever is moved from the islands to the mainland, that they will not accept their return. And so they keep the asylum seekers in the islands in order to implement this externalization arrangement. As for universities, one idea, and since I am a lawyer, that I have seen practiced a lot in Belgium and in the Netherlands is actually the creation of legal clinics specifically on migration. So you mentioned your collaboration also with the Greek Council for Refugees. I also volunteered there as a lawyer a decade ago. And so one idea would be to combine forces with specialized NGOs and law schools in Greece in order to create such a legal clinic, and actually students assisting in the preparatory phases of such asylum cases.
Excuse me, could I just...
Yeah, please. The
question about first reception, it is not in the prerogative of Turkey or anybody else to decide where you do the first reception and identification processing of people. The fact that politicians evoke the Turkish authorities is simply for deflating the their own,
responsibility.
Because a sovereign country can decide to process the application wherever it wants within its territory.
Thank you. Let's take another round of questions. Can we take Manos over here, please?
Thank you. Manolis Galinianos. I'm a professor of economics at Royal Holloway University. So one of the better ways for migrants to integrate in a society is through the labor market. And actually, Greece has had some success in the 90s. So I was wondering if you find, in your experience, that refugees who gain the right to remain in Greece, whether they have been able to integrate in the labor market, so to find jobs, and perhaps the ones whose claims are still processed, whether they informally and illegally, I guess, whether they have managed or tried to find jobs there. Thank you.
Many thanks. And then could we take this lady here, please?
Thank you. Miria Georgi, I'm a professor here at the LSE.
My question is for Mr. Papadanakis, and I wanted to ask you if you could say something more about the role of cities at the moment in Europe. You touched upon this question about the responsibility and the fact that in many ways the so-called refugee crisis is mostly an urban issue. Is there a political role for cities to play in Europe at present, especially in the context of the hesitation of the European Union and the nation state to accept that migration is part of the reality of Europe?
Many thanks.
Is there a role, and especially within those networks that you're participating in Europe and in the country? Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Can we take the gentleman here in blue?
Hi, good evening, everyone. I'm currently studying in sixth form, doing my A-levels. And recently, me and a group of like 15 individuals did a trek across Europe to raise funds for this cause. And collectively, we raised like £30,000. And I just want to know, like, what is the best way to, you know, utilize this money? Because, as you say, that there's a lot of funding, there's a lot of donations going to charity, but is this actually helping? Like, it's gutting to know that the food chains are giving people the wrong food or giving undercooked meals. Like, what is the solution?
Thank you. Can you just tell us the name of the organization again? You were collecting money, raising money?
Yes, yeah, so the organization... Time to Help UK. So please, everyone, if you want to donate, there's still going
okay.
on.
Okay. Many thanks. And then Platon at the front here, please.
I'm Platon Tignes from the University of Paris. I'm just looking at the title, Immigration and Refugee Crisis. Now, there seems to be a very rigid distinction between immigration and refugee status. And I'm just wondering, is this a helpful distinction? Is it hopefully outdated? And if so, what can we put in its place, if anything?
Very good. Thank you. We're going to run out of time. So can I invite the panel members to respond briefly, and perhaps not to each question. To go in reverse order, Lillian, would you like to possibly address the last question?
Yes, that was the question that I had in mind. So the issue of mentioning migrants and refugees differently has a lot to do with the legal guarantees that surround refugees, which are, when it comes to irregular migrants, they are more strengthened than the ones that pertain to the ones relating to refugees are stronger than the ones relating to migrants, and hence this is the practical reason why this distinction is often being highlighted. Now, that being said, every individual has human rights. The principle of human dignity applies to everyone. Also, the prohibition of torture, inhuman or degrading treatment. And our mind shouldn't only go to torture, but detention conditions have been found in certain places to constitute inhuman or degrading treatment. Or in other cases, one could argue that leaving individuals in full destitution also constitutes inhuman or degrading treatment. So this distinction and the different legal frameworks shouldn't lead us to the conclusion that irregular migrants do not have rights or that states can use inhuman treatment as a deterrence or as a policy implement.
Thank you. Leftali, there's a question about cities.
Yeah. If you asked that question 3 to 4 years ago, the answer would be very easy. In the European level, cities have no power. But since then, and because in part of the migration reality, cities have been more active, and because they are doing a lot of lobby and they do put a lot of pressure on the European Commission and the Member States, they have a role in the discussions concerning migration. They cannot decide, and the role is not very, very political, but they have been present, and now they are an equal partner in the discussion. Again, it's an evolution, it's going to take a while, but it is being proven that since cities are doing the work, they have to be present. We are asking for direct funding, direct European funding, because as you know, we don't have access to European funding. We have to go through the regions, et cetera, et cetera. And this is an ongoing discussion, and it's a very interesting one, because we are also, and again, it's a bit of exaggeration, we are also asking ourselves if we are coming back to the principle of city-state. You know that in Germany this is the case because the federal model works like this, but in other countries it's not the same. So slowly we have cities that are taking upon themselves to do more. And for example, I will end with that. When countries didn't sign the Global Compact of Migration and on Refugees, there were several local authorities and cities who signed on their place. I mean, Italy didn't sign it, but Milan and other Italian cities signed it. The United States didn't sign the Global Compact, but many, many major American cities signed it. New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, etc., etc. So we see in some cases where cities take the place of the countries in order to demonstrate their willingness to be present. This is a process. It's going to take a while, but if I can remember what happened before, what was happening four or five years ago, this has changed a lot. So yes, it's a very interesting process. And I think that in the end, cities will win, if you want. They will find a more political place in this process.
Thanks. Antigone, there's a question about the labour market.
Employment, yep.
And then there's also a question about, from our friend here, studying A-levels, having raised charitable money in the UK, what would be the priority for spending it on?
Okay. So, regarding employment opportunities and integration into the society via independent employment, I think that we have and how invigorating this is, not only for the individuals who get a job, but also for the economy that is hosting the individual. We have this precedent of the late 90s, early noughts, when I want to remind everybody, almost a million of economic migrants arrived to Greece at a time of relatively high unemployment. And the authorities at the time said that we have high unemployment, we cannot accommodate these people. And wherever the migrants went, the unemployment rate went down because the supply of work in a rigid labor market created opportunities for investment, for new activities, and this is the story that we have to draw a very clear message that integration into the labor market works, it always works, and it also creates a better environment for all of us to live in. The good thing about Greece is that in contrary to what happens in the Middle East, for instance, in the Middle East, people, refugees in camps, are not allowed to work. They don't get a work permit. In Greece, they are allowed to work. So the people who are not stranded in camps in the middle of nowhere may have lots of gainful opportunities. In our employability centers, we have a success rate of 20% of all the people who come and look for a job, and we put them either in training or in placements. We have previous discussions with employers. There are lots of jobs that need to be done, and not a lot of Greek people who want to do them. The only problem is that if the person has to move from Athens to Pelion in order to for the crop for the apples, he runs the risk of losing his home, his subsidized home. There has to be some adjustment in the rules of the game that would unleash this potential, and I'm very confident that this is going to work. Now, concerning donations, what we saw with the refugees, but also with the fires emergencies in last summer in Greece, is that donations in kind sometimes are a dead weight, that you don't, I mean, you get lots of things that you don't need and no things that you need. The best thing in terms of donations is things that create life chances, like scholarships, paid training courses for specific people so that you can follow and monitor what's happening. Otherwise, it is very difficult to somehow evaluate and monitor what's happening. So this is an open plea for scholarships, because the Greek university system is closed for refugees. There are lots of aspiring and really clever young individuals who would need to pursue higher education. There are some higher education private establishments in Greece who offer opportunities and scholarships, but not enough for those interested. So if anybody wants to donate, there is a very good, a very good purpose for this money. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Just before closing, can I mention, of course, that we have a series of public events, seminars, etc., on Greece in the Hellenic Observatory here at the LSE. So do please look at our website for upcoming events. It is, I think, this evening a very good discussion with a very complex and wide agenda. Thank you for your questions. We have not had time to deal with everything perhaps as fully as we would wish, but certainly we've had experts' contributions from our panelists, and I thank them profusely. Can you please thank our panel?
Many thanks indeed. Thank you.